Join the conversation. You're with Cape Talk.
Time to talk health and wellness, and we're putting the focus on heat today. You might have heard the news reports last week of four learners at a high school in Boortersig who apparently suffered heat stroke while competing in the school's athletics day. Students at Bosmansdam High, they were treated on scene and then taken to hospital for further observation just as a precaution, and hoping, as we say this, that they've made a full recovery. But we thought it would be an opportune time to talk about heat stroke and about the importance of taking the impact of heat seriously. Just before I introduce our guest, earlier in the show, Trish wrote in to say, I had just driven past Bergfried High School where they're having their sports day, and Trish told us she'd seen an ambulance driving in with its lights on, and she was hoping that it wasn't another case of heat stroke, and saying, why do schools host these events during the first month or two when the weather is so, so warm? Well, thank you very much. Stephen Price, the principal of Bergfried High, contacted us during the news to say, just to put that caller and any other listeners at ease, there have been no incidents of heat stroke today. Fortunately, the wind has kept things cool for them. The ambulance was called for a learner who had had a severe panic attack. It was completely separate from the sports event, and her parents have been called and she's been taken to hospital just out of an abundance of caution. So it is not related in any way to the sports event. Stephen, appreciate that quick feedback. Thank you very much, because I'm sure anybody who heard that who had a child at Bergfried today might have been worrying. So it's good to be able to allay those fears. But with me in studio to help us prevent having to worry about such things is Dr. Darren Green, emergency and sports physician, currently working as the corporate events manager for MediClinic Southern Africa and a long time contributor to the show, although it's been far too long since we had you here. Darren, it's lovely to see you back again.
Thank you very much. Great to be back.
So, I mean, you spend a lot of your time doctoring on the sidelines of big sporting events, the Cape Epic, the rugby games, etc. Do people underestimate the impact of heat, particularly during exercise?
They do indeed. I think nobody thinks about, you know, what puts you at risk of developing, firstly, heat exhaustion, yeah, and then secondly, heat stroke, because that's the spectrum, by the
okay.
way. So I think understanding how the environmental conditions then can affect your physiology and your body's natural compensatory mechanisms, that's yeah. where people underestimate it. They have no idea when those mechanisms become exhausted and what the warning signs are. And I think that's what triggers the whole cascade.
Okay, so before we delve into the physics of it, I mean, just a thought, it's a difficult one. It's athletics season. It is a summer sport.
Yes.
Everybody tries to get it out the way before exams are looming and that sort of thing. But I mean, any guidelines? I mean, should schools be reconsidering having a sports event on a day when we know the temperature is going to be over 30 degrees, for example?
Yeah, it's so hard because the year planning of the schools, yeah. I mean, I'm experiencing this with my own kids at high school right now. If you think about it, the winter rugby sports and soccer sports need yeah. to start training, pre-season training. They yeah. can't do that until athletic season is finished, completed. They okay. can't start contact trials, etc. So schools are confronted with that challenge as to where to introduce the different season change in sports.
Right.
The other thing is that for the conditions for athletics, you want pristine conditions for the best times. For sprinting, for example, you don't want headwinds, you don't want a yeah. wet track. For long distance and middle distance running, the conditions play a massive role in your times. So you actually want good weather. And I remember our school days in Craddock and PE, etc. And traveling around, how high altitude plays a role, etc., etc. So environmental conditions, crucial. But obviously with that comes a degree of predictability, but you only get accurate weather predictions in terms of what your heat stress index is going to be, your humidity content in the air.
Yeah.
In the week leading up to the event. And by that time, there's so much planning and year planning that's been done. It's difficult for people
difficult
to move
to pull
around.
The plug yeah. and say this
then
is
it's contingency yeah. planning. What have you done to actually manage the risk? And that's yeah. what we can talk
so
about.
So we'll talk about that as well. Yeah. Just for the record, previously when we have spoken to the education department about this, I know there are guidelines in place that over a certain temperature, their advice to schools is to cancel. But it's quite on the extreme side of a hot temperature. It's not 30 degrees. It's more,
correct.
I think, closing on 40 before that happens. So just bear that in mind. Okay, so Darren, let's talk about physically what goes on in the body when it is subjected to extreme temperatures. And you did mention the two different phases of heat exhaustion and heat stroke. Do you want to talk us through that spectrum?
100%. So your body can handle an increase in core body temperature.
Okay.
And we all know normal body temperature is around about 37, 37.6. We start worrying about fever if it accelerates above that. So in conditions where you're exposed for prolonged periods of time to heat, your core body temperature will go up. And with that, you can imagine the demands of fluid, mm-hmm. which are important in your cooling mechanism of sweating or perspiring, yeah. rather, in bringing down the body temperature becomes plays an important role. The shift of salts and electrolytes between the cells, all that plays a role in blood pressure, circulation to the skin, and then the cooling mechanisms that then follow. With your breathing rate, breathing, like a dog panting,
yep.
to bring down your body temperature as well. So what happens is you can compensate with your core body temperature going up slowly, slowly, slowly. When it hits 40 degrees, you're already at risk for heat stroke. So okay. let's talk about the preceding thing, which is heat exhaustion. That's where you might look a bit cheek slapped, a little bit pink.
Yep.
If you feel the skin, it might be a little bit cold and clammy still at that time because you still have fluid.
Yeah.
You also might feel a little bit parched, a little bit tired. You can progress to feel a little bit nauseous and have a mild headache. When it goes through that stage and your core body temperature rises to about 40 degrees without you having corrected or done anything to prevent it progressing, you will then move into the heat stroke stage where if you don't reverse it within 30 minutes, the cells of the body start undergoing damage where they can't perform their function in all the systems. I'm speaking about GIT, your nervous system, your cardiac system, your kidneys and your liver, for example.
Gosh.
And that's when heat stroke kicks in. And if you don't get that right and reversed within a certain period of time, it progresses to an altered mental status, confusion, vomiting, and then eventually seizures and then death. So that's the reality.
The reality, if it's left untreated, unmanaged, just to accelerate, and if you don't intervene. Okay, that's pretty sobering stuff. I mean, Darren, management, you would immediately think, obviously, cold water. I think most people's response would be drink the coldest water you could get your hands on. Is that the right thing to do?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. So cooling can happen, via a few ways. So definitely, if you think about having access to water, important. Even having water with towels dipped in water on the surface of the skin in terms of cooling is important.
Yeah.
The old people had something wise that they said, always expose your feet. Open your feet up because, heat in your socks, for example, under your armpits, in the groin. Those are the areas when we're actively cooling a resus case where we pack ice under the armpits, in the groin, under the feet, behind the neck. Those are your thermal control centers, which are quite important in terms of radiating heat. So that's where you cool the body rapidly. And we sometimes in eventing medicine, when we have someone with heat stroke, core body temperature is measured with a rectal probe because they're unconscious at that time. Needs to be accurate. And if it's about 40, 42 degrees, we actually immerse them in an ice bath. On events like the Cape Epic, etc., if I'm confronted with that, we often have a rubber dinghy, like a rubber duck, which we fill with ice and water as a rapid cooling mechanism
help.
And then we pack cold towels on the patient and under each, as I said, each crevice.
So again, back of the neck, groins, armpits, and bottom of the feet, important centers to remember where you need to be paying attention.
And that's in the heat stroke. Before that, you can drink cold water, move into the shade, obviously dampen. People use buffs quite often.
Yes.
Dip them in some ice and cold water, wipe your face, keep the back of your neck cool. Those are useful things. Have a simple plastic 2-liter bottle that you keep pouring water over your head with and cooling yourself down. And then movement of air and wind, fanning yourself, actually works.
Yeah.
Does work.
You took the words out of my mouth. I'm thinking back to we were incredibly lucky to go and visit friends in Botswana and in the middle of a very, very, very hot summer season. And their advice was, everybody on must have a sarong with them. You wet the sarong, you wrap it around you. And as you're moving on the vehicle, the wind blowing
cools you down
through that wet fabric. And it was remarkably, remarkably effective. Darren, somebody making a very important a comparison here, saying in Australia, it is compulsory for all learners to wear hats and sunscreen. Sure. I've said it before. My school, high school principal, the late Frank Simmons, was ahead of his time on that. In 1990, it would have been, it was compulsory. We were not allowed to go outside on the sports field without hats and sunscreen. He had sunscreen installs, administrator things in the bathrooms, and everybody laughed at the time, and nobody's laughing now. Would you support it being made compulsory here in South Africa?
No, absolutely. I mean, it's about exposure to UV and your duration in the sun. So if you think about guys, I mean, we used to do cadets and stay in army training and all that kind of thing. You're in the sun for hours and you're standing dead still in direct sunlight. So having protection certainly helps. But the frequency of breaks, even while you're training, doing athletics, playing rugby matches or hockey games, increased water break frequency to consume water, etc. as well, are all worked in to the schedule when you have these higher exposures. And if anyone doesn't know, you get an instrument that's called a heat stress monitor that schools can actually look at. And you can actually get a heat stress, a humidex chart, that you can actually get an idea as to what your risk is of heat stress by using this instrument called a heat stress monitor.
Yeah.
And then correlating the values with this chart, showing you in which zone you are for risk, which then helps you better prepare your water and ice plan for an event. So that's also quite useful for people to know.
You know, somebody's just saying here, please can your guests comment on the fact that primary schools are starting rugby practice now already, an unbearable schedule if the kid also plays a summer sport. There is the fear of losing their place in the team if they say, no, I want to finish my cricket or tennis first. I mean, you referenced this already. But Darren, I mean,
it's a good point.
There's not just the risk of the sun, there's then a risk of overtraining and too much activity, isn't there?
So we're seeing exactly that. So you must imagine they're playing cricket. After cricket, they're at 4:30, they're starting then the evening rugby pre-season training. The amount of time that kids are spending in their sports gear in terms of, let's say, studs or spikes, cricket spikes or rugby togs, for example, stud pressure and the amount of shock on the shins and the lower legs leads to things like shin splints and other forms of tendonitis, etc. in the kids from overtraining. So that conditioning needs to happen on different surfaces over a period of time. So if they haven't trained the entire December period on grass and so forth, and they suddenly hit Astro or tartan in summer, you can imagine the effect from a sports medicine perspective on the types of injuries that they get. And we do see them, the ankle injuries, the knee injuries, etc.
That's pretty scary, and it's a hard thing to stop in its tracks. As you say, you don't want to be the kid who's saying, I can't start rugby yet, I'm still busy finishing cricket season, or the parents saying, it's too much. It's a hard conversation to start.
Schools need to be educated in terms of planning the workload in terms of the different sports, and then looking at the duration of practices, perhaps alternating days of the week, etc., in managing that load. And I think that's important.
Feeling like we need to send you off to all the high schools to speak to them about this, Darren. We had our conversation about vaping earlier in the week with Richard Finzel-Smith, who's visiting them all, having the conversation about managing that. But it sounds to me like this is something that really needs to be taken seriously. Is there something you can eat or drink to avoid heat stroke, asks a listener. And then, oh, the million-dollar question that always irks me. Why must the learners wear blazers in this heat? I'm totally with you on that. But, eating, drinking, obviously you drink water when you're seeing signs, but preventative drinking or eating of cold things?
There's
a
wonderful thing called a sweat rate. So when I work with elite athletes and people that are really serious about sport, you must imagine they riding on a bicycle, let's say, for 6 hours. They do an exercise ride on a Saturday morning. You weigh yourself naked. You get on the bike. You take your 1.5 liters of fluid. And then whatever you training in those conditions, you consume your liquid that you've taken, and then you weigh yourself on your return. You can actually see how much you've lost through
sweating.
And that gives you an idea as to how much you need to actually rehydrate and adjust your hydration. With heat stress, we have low risk, medium risk, high risk. In events, I often put up flags and colors like red, orange, green at events so that the rider or the runner in a marathon knows whether they need to increase their ingestion of fluid intake. And you always drink to thirst is number one. And if you're not urinating, you have a problem. The color of the urine tells you something. If it's coke-colored or dark-colored, it could mean that you have a really serious condition affecting the kidneys, which is called rhabdomyolysis, where the muscle gets broken down. And those toxins, obviously, are then secreted through the urine, can damage the kidneys, and you could end up with permanent kidney damage.
Just for those who might have joined us late to the conversation, we're talking heat stroke, heat exhaustion, heat management, particularly with regard to schools and sporting events in the summertime. My guest in studio, Dr. Darren Green, who is an emergency and sports physician, currently working as corporate events manager for MediClinic Southern Africa. And you will often spot him, although he's never still for long, buzzing around on the sidelines of big sporting events because he is the person that they call when things go wrong, like a case of heat stroke. Now, a great question. Given all that you've said about the physiology of the body and how it reacts under heat. Please explain the sauna or steam room heat, says our message, and how does the body cope with that?
Great
question.
Wonderful. So if you spent 4 hours in a sauna, you'd look like a dried out prune. And certainly there could be some physiological damage affecting your kidneys and your electrolyte status if you did that for prolonged periods of time. But the sauna experience, or like some people say, the sauna, is wonderful in the sense that it raises your body temperature, like the Turkish baths. And when it comes to your feel-good hormones and your endorphins being released, raising your core body temperature and then cooling it down with ice water is associated with that process. You can imagine things like chili, for example, yes. and hot food with capsaicin and capsaic acid. Exactly the same effect as to why people become addicted to hot food and chilies. They have a central core temperature that raises and an increased surge of the endorphins that are released while eating hot food. And they become used to that rush that they experience after that. Almost like an addiction to gambling or anything else that you get. So, yeah, that's important. So sauna is obviously the duration of time, the amount of fluid you are and then losing, and then the time it takes to cool your body back down to normal temperature is essential. You often find you go into a steam room and then take a cold shower, then you go back.
Yes.
So you do dry sauna or you do steam room. So there's humidity content in the one and the other one's dry.
Yeah.
But you're always timing those periods and you're ingesting water while doing that. So it's not like 6 hours, for example. Yeah. It's like 45 minutes for most people. And most people have claustrophobia or fear
of someone
naked in the sauna anyway. So
I'm thinking back to my last sauna, which was in Antarctica, Darren, just after I'd done a polar plunge swim.
Wow.
And I've never felt so good in my life as I was walking into the room and going, oh, I can feel my fingertips and my toes again.
Wow.
But again, it took about 5 minutes to undo a -3 degree swim, and then I had to get out of there because my body was going, you're too hot.
Too hot.
Yeah. And I was thirsty. That was the interesting thing. Now, we've spoken about fluid intake. What about electrolyte content in fluid?
Great.
Does it have a role to play?
100%. So people ask me a lot with events about cramping as well. So you think about the cycle tour. You always think about everyone taking Enos and Coke along the way. What's the evidence-based medicine for that?
Yeah.
Simply there isn't. So why do people take it? Well, the reflux and then the Coke obviously gives them a bit of energy, etc. But let's get back to the physiology. So the most common cause of cramping is actually poor conditioning. In other words, people that haven't done the mileage and then now suddenly demand a lot. So the organ that's responsible for cramping in the muscle is called the Golgi tendon organ.
Okay.
And what happens is as it's stretched, if it's stretched too quickly, it actually shuts the muscle down and cramps it to protect it. Okay, so what happens is with these exhaustive phases, you often have that. And some people have a propensity genetically to develop cramping.
Okay.
Others have to have severe medical electrolyte disturbances like calcium and magnesium. So you'll see people love taking salt tablets, which is sodium, which does play a role in muscle physiology as well. And then obviously your calcium and magnesium. Slow mag, you often hear them asking, can I get some magnesium, etc. Yeah. Important, but those normally are in people with an underlying medical condition with a low magnesium that need it. So, and then I've heard some incredible stories, for those that want to read up on it, on pickle juice. You know, like gherkins in a jar? That pickle juice works for cramping in muscle cramping. Even in competitions like the Ironman in Hawaii, I think my professor Wayne Derman at Stellenbosch, he taught us or told us about his experience actually working in the race tent.
Yeah.
In Hawaii. Why? We don't know. Does it work? We see people relieved on the pickle juice. So anyway. But
Send me the gherkins and you can have the juice. So, okay. Like a deal.
So interesting. But the most common cause, as I say, is either medically underlying condition with electrolyte
deficiency
or deficiency, and then the poor conditioning.
Now, somebody asking a follow-up question, is there any way of testing on scene which electrolytes are low so that you can compensate?
Yeah, so I do that with my big events. In the race tents, when we bring someone in that's cramping, that's hot, etc., that's having a poor urine output, we have on-site point of care UNE testing, which is urea and electrolytes.
Okay.
Checking kidney function, sodium, potassium, creatinines, etc. That gives an idea of the kidney function. And then we also do dipsticks looking for blood in the urine to see whether that filter of the kidney is being affected or protein or blood is leaking into the urine due to early kidney failure.
Okay, so let's just to circle back in our final minute, Darren. I mean, you've very clearly spelled out the warning signs to look for and the things to be cognizant of if you're organizing a sporting event, mitigating the risk, managing what you can, having enough water laid in, being prepared for the possibility of having to do first aid treatment. You've spoken to us about what that first aid would involve. Mm. Final question before we're out of time. If you've administered first aid to somebody, what is the sign that they're sufficiently recovered and you can let them go on their way? And And when should you go, you know what, like they did at Buitenzorg, we're calling an ambulance and checking this at hospital?
Yeah, it's cool first, transfer later. I think that's very important. So when you see someone's skin dry to the touch and they're a little bit sleepy and they've been exposed for a long time, the chances are very high that they could have a core body temperature above 40 degrees. Then you rush with wet towels, fanning equipment, ice under every crevice, as I've mentioned already, and you activate the emergency response by calling for an ambulance. And while you're waiting for the ambulance, you keep on changing those towels, fanning, water, constant changing to keep it as cool as you can. That's what you can do to help. And then moving them into a shady place is another big step that we often don't think of. So if you can put or cover, you know, cover the person with an umbrella or hold, ask someone to hold up a shield while you while you're busy trying to cool them. That could be life-saving therapy. Remember the 30 minutes, once they've hit 40 degrees, there's a 30-minute period in which the cells start undergoing metabolic damage, which is permanent. And then they'll start fitting after that. Yeah. So you need to, in that time, it's crucial time. But it's cooling first, transfer later. So the cooling is very important while you're waiting for the ambulance.
And it's clearly not to be taken lightly. Darren, thank you so much. You've done a lot to hopefully educate parents listening who in turn can feed this back to the schools about what's happening at those sports days. Dr. Darren Green, lovely to have you back with us again.